The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I'm recording. Kate, are you good to go?
Yes, good to go.
Okay, great. Josh, whenever you're ready, I can count us in. All right. 3, 2, 1.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. This is our third episode when we are doing this remote. I was just thinking this morning that this is 2 weeks since we as an organization have been all on remote work. And when we started this, it sort of seemed like, oh, you know, kind of ahead of the curve, you know,
right.
You think that's you think that's overdoing it or something, you know, having everybody working remote. And obviously things have moved pretty rapidly since then, the whole large sections of the country. I actually saw I was seeing this statistic that something like, you know, a significant portion of the global population is under some kind of lockdown right now.
Right. India just announced their population of like 1.3 billion people is basically locked down. So
it's funny. I have this sense that the number I heard was like 1.3 billion, but it has to be a lot more than that. Because most of Europe is on lockdown.
No, I'm talking about just India alone. Yeah.
Right. No, that's what I'm saying. So clearly, if all of India is on a lockdown, and that's 1.3 billion, a significant amount of China is still in some kind of lockdown, although they're opening things up. Mm-hmm. A lot of the U.S. It seems like it must be something closer to a third or maybe even approaching half of the world population. Obviously, lockdown can mean a lot of different things. But, you know, it's all these crazy things that one thinks about. I mean, everybody has in their life big events, disasters that you've been close to, had some proximity to. And you think about later, you'll tell people about it. Oh, here's what it was like. Who are you going to tell about this, right? Everybody in the world is experiencing this. Now, obviously, some people are experiencing this in much more grievous and acute ways than we, at least for now, are experiencing it. But it's a weird thing to think this is happening to the entire human species at the moment. And certainly it's happening in a particular way to everybody who is connected in some sense to news throughout the world, which is most of the world population, obviously not all. In any case, let's quickly get through. I want to remind you that Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is the sponsor of the Josh Marshall Podcast. And I was actually talking to Grady this morning.
How's he doing?
You know, he's doing okay. They are on basically sort of a skeleton crew production at their location in the Bronx, and they're allowed to keep going because they're a food and beverage manufacturer. That's critical. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't come under all the stand down kind of things. So that is great. And he told me that they are continuing to do. You know, they're shipping throughout the United States, and you can get the bean in the bag or the box with you buy the liquid, the bottles,
right.
Whatever. So in any case, we're sort of playing everything by ear, but it is a great product, and you should be supporting everybody, all the businesses that you care about and and would like to support in a moment like this doesn't just apply to Grady's, but obviously Grady's as well. So you can go to gradyscoldbrew.com and you can order it there, and you can also order it by Amazon and all that kind of stuff. In any case, Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee, sponsored Josh Marshall podcast. They're still up and running. It's a great product. And, you know, you're not going to be hitting coffee shops for a while, probably. So,
well, I was going to say it's more important than ever before, because I went to the 7-Eleven on our block to get coffee this morning, and everyone in there was in suit, like hazmat suits and masks, and were kind of like buds with the cashier, and he came out and he was like, apparently someone in there was like coughing a lot, so now they've shut everything down or scrubbing everything, and I don't know.
It's you know, what is safe and what is not safe is gonna vary a lot in depending on where you are. So everybody be safe. Support especially small businesses that you can support in your area. And again, obviously, whether that means ordering things to be delivered or curbside pickup, you need to make that decision depending on what's going on in your area. And that's it. So Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. All right, let's get down to business of global epidemic disaster.
So yeah, I wanted to start by talking about New York and New York City specifically. And there's a tendency in the media to overfocus on New York. Obviously, this is the center of the United States economy. Basically, it's the biggest city in the country, and you know, beyond that, every major news organization is based here. So when things impact the New York metro area, it just gets disproportionate coverage. But in the cases of coronavirus, it's also the epicenter of the pandemic. And so we've seen, just before we got online to record the podcast, Andrew Cuomo was giving another update on his state's response and the number of cases. And, you know, as recently as yesterday and even through today, I mean, he's been painting a pretty dire picture of the situation here, right? The state, I think, has something like 50,000 hospital beds available to it. They need more than twice that amount, I think up to 140,000 beds. So they're asking hospitals to increase capacity twofold, at least.
Until the new data that came out starting about 36 hours ago, the idea was that the state would need 100,000 beds. They have 50,000 beds. They gave an order, basically everybody has to get up to 50% of what they can do now, i.e. so then you get statewide up to 75, and then everything you can do 100%, which would get the state up to 100 if every hospital did it. And then we had the new numbers that came out again about 36 hours ago that said, you know what, it's worse than we thought, and we're going to need that to be 140,000. So it's
So
it sucks. It's really bleak, bad.
A bleak situation. And on top of this, we've had President Trump kind of publicly butting heads with Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, and some reporting overnight that suggests basically if governors who are presiding over states with large numbers of cases, we're talking about California, Washington State, New York, if you're not nice to Trump, basically you might find yourself short several thousand ventilators, or maybe your phone calls aren't going to get answered. Josh, tell us more about that whole situation. And you were kind of going off on Twitter this morning about maybe the federal government could want some bagels in exchange for some critical health supplies. But kind of run us through what the deal is here.
Well, it should be obvious to everyone, the states, you know, again, the states don't really exist as a thing. They're just an administrative division in a country. But whether you're talking about the individual people or the states, Trump clearly sees what he is and what he's in control of as he owns the country. He owns the government, and if you want him to do you a favor, you should be nice to him. You know, if we were all running out of food and there was one guy at the end of the block who had a huge stockpile, you'd be nice to him. right? I mean, you'd say like, hey, mm-hmm. whatever disagreements we had in the past, you know, I hope we can put that behind us because we really need the food. Mm-hmm. But obviously that's not really what's happening here. Donald Trump is someone we've hired to run things, and it's not his food. But clearly he does not see it that way. And, you know, we have already seen over 3 years repeatedly that he sees what he's doing as protecting his people, his core voters, you know, the states that support him and stuff like that. We've seen this in trade policy where, you know, kind of people he sees as key supporters, you know, farmers and agricultural states, he's basically just going to kind of pour money on them to offset the, you know, the impacts of his trade policy. And so we've seen this approach, this way he sees his job, the way he sees things a lot. It's nothing new. It just becomes a lot more dramatic when it's like, do you need the ventilators? You know, the ventilators that will stop people from gasping to death, from asphyxiating because they have this thing. So it is really, it's criminal, the level of stuff we are talking about. It is true that the country probably does not have enough altogether to help everybody. But I think it is very clear at this point that the president has been slow, bartering. You know, he doesn't like the blue states. And so he's just not in a rush to help us.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, you could almost see it. You could see this coming from the beginning of his presidency, right? Because most presidents, you know, when they kind of take the helm, at least start out from the perspective of, you know, I'm president of everyone, not just the people who voted for me. And, you know, Trump has never taken that tack. But I think kind of what you're laying out, Josh, was really clear to me when I was reading the transcript of the call the White House had with a bunch of governors. And, you know, there were some like ridiculous details that came out about Trump's behavior during the call afterwards. You know, people were saying that he was getting tired by the end and trying to make the governors like rush their pleas for help along. But I was reading it particularly because in Louisiana, New Orleans is basically exploding with coronavirus cases. And so Governor John Bel Edwards sent the White House a plea for help, for aid, you know, said that they have right now about 1,200 cases and they have 381 available ICU beds. He predicted that New Orleans will be, their hospital capacity will be overwhelmed by April 4th, which is basically in a week. But, you know, you read the transcript of the call and all of them have to do the same kind of stuff, the same, you know, dear leader, you've been doing a great job, you know, just want to put out there, my state is dying, so, you know, if you could throw us a few bucks, that would be helpful.
Now, did he react differently? Because that's a case where it's a red state, but it has a Democratic governor. So what was his reaction like to Bel Edwards?
I mean, I would say there, it wasn't very revelatory what he said. It was kind of, oh, what was that second request? Okay, I hear ya. Gotcha. Moving on. Next governor list to get through. But yeah, and I spoke to Bel Edwards' office, and his spokeswoman said that they hadn't heard back from the White House as of yesterday. They sent the letter on Monday, but she actually said that they expect him to approve, you know, the kind of emergency declaration they're trying to get their state put under, which unlocks aid for them. But she said she expects it because he already okayed it for places like California, which is kind of telling with what you're saying, Josh. Like, oh, he already gave it to this other place that he hates. So our red state is probably good to go, notwithstanding that the epicenter is, you know, the blue bastion in Louisiana.
Right. Well, it is a funny thing because, I mean, again, it's. You know, does he like them or not?
Right.
You know, they're a red state, but they elected a Democratic governor. And you have, you know, you have states like, you know, I never know how to pronounce it, Bashar, you know, the governor of Kentucky, Democrat, you know, very, a very red state, extremely red state in national politics, but a Democratic governor. And this is something that I have noticed, because as many people have been, I've been watching the Cuomo press conferences very closely every day. And he has had moments where, and this is, and it's been the same with Gavin Newsom in California. They've had moments when they've been somewhat critical. You know, they're begging for federal aid, but they have also gone out of their way. You know, thank you so much for the for these hospitals. Thank you so much for this. Thank you so much for that. And you know, even in a normal situation, or let me put it this way, even in a crisis with a normal president, it still makes sense. You know, thank you for getting us this. You know, great. You know, you moved it ahead, all that stuff. It's not that it's you know, acknowledging assistance is great, but it's clear they have been forced to make this calculus of this guy sucks. This guy is at best dragging his feet to give us critical assistance that will mean life or death for individuals right now. And yet, as me as a governor, I need to do what I need to do everything I can for my state population. And right now, that means really doing everything I can to be nice to this guy and not get him mad at me. And that is just, I don't know what kind of reckoning will be possible, will come, but it is just, it's bad at a level that is beyond anything that I have any experience with in certainly in my lifetime in U.S. politics, and maybe ever. You know, look, it's not, it this is happening around the world. It's not like Trump created this virus and a lot of people were going to die regardless. Mm-hmm. But it is one thing people die, it's another thing because some people are going to die because of this guy's ego,
right,
and his power trip, well, and the fact that he's really just like a sociopath.
A really interesting offshoot of kind of what you're saying is, I was reporting on the Liberty University thing yesterday, which is that basically Jerry Falwell has staked out his position of support for Trump translates to an actual quote he said earlier this week, is that Democrats are fanning, or the media is fanning the flames of this to ruin the economy because they do anything to hurt Trump, kind of deal. So they're welcoming thousands of students back onto campus after spring break, whereas, you know, nationwide colleges have pretty much closed down for the rest of the academic year, sent the students to do virtual learning from their parents' houses or whatever. And, you know, Falwell was just, it was as if not taking coronavirus seriously is a mark of your loyalty to Trump, is basically how he was construing it, which is, as insane as that is, it's just, I mean, in Falwell's case, he is willing to be the reason that some of, I mean, if this goes through, so many of his students are going to get sick. Like, some of them will probably die. And this, he's still expecting faculty to report to campus and do office hours. Not to mention the people who live in, you know, Lynchburg, Virginia, around the university. And for all Falwell's, you know, all these kids are young, you know, they're not at risk. It's, first of all, you have no idea who's got underlying issues. But aside from that, okay, so your young, not at risk students are going to go walk around the neighborhood where older at risk people live. So I think the movement of demonstrating your loyalty to Trump in this case means willingly not taking a pandemic seriously and putting people who you're in charge of, in this case, students, directly in the line of danger. You know, I was just so stunned when I was just reading it, and his brazenness and his, you know, he was talking on a radio show about the spring breakers that everyone's been talking about, you know, how all these young kids are still going to the beach and, you know, clubs are just kind of ignoring social distancing. And he just basically chuckled and was like, oh, well, everyone's invincible at that age. You know, it was just horrific.
Yeah. And obviously there's another kind of related theme emerging, which is Trump saying the cure can't be worse than the problem, and the problem, right, being coronavirus, and the cure being obviously the extreme social distancing, the closing of restaurants and non-essential businesses. Mm-hmm. And there's just this emerging idea that's kind of gaining steam on the right that we need to get back to work. And Trump wants to reopen the economy by Easter and have churches packed on Easter Sunday and all this, you know, Fox News, Bill Hemmer, who's not like one of the diehard...
he used to be on CNN. I mean,
primetime guys.
Yeah, through kind of real news. I mean, maybe
he was saying, oh, it would be a great American resurrection when the economy gets back going on Easter. And, you know, Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, went on Tucker Carlson's show this week to say, oh, people like me, we'll take care of ourselves. And, you know, people should be willing to get back out there in order to save the economy for our grandchildren. Glenn Beck yesterday, I think, you know, he's diminished as a, I guess, important person to listen to just in general. But, you know, he said he'd basically be willing to die in order to, like, rescue the economy. It's just this kind of
The economy is this, like, golden calf icon that people are like, you should be willing to lay down your life to save the stock market. Like, what?
Yeah, it's a very weird thing because, you know, people mean a lot of different things when they talk about the economy. You know, the economy, I mean, some people, it means the stock market, which is just like, you know, who cares about, you know, people's like equities portfolios. It also means people having jobs,
right,
and being able to buy food and you know, really basic things that do have real, I mean, in that sense, the economy is just everybody's collective livelihood.
Right.
And as is always the case, certain people are much more vulnerable than others. People who are fairly well off, they cannot have much income for a while and they have, you know, reserves and stuff like that. And other people immediately can't pay their rent, immediately can't buy food and stuff like that. And it is true that extreme economic shocks not only affect people's, you know, livelihood in a money sense, it affects people's lives.
Right.
You know, those things, people don't go to doctors, people, you know, there are all sorts of knock-on effects. And so, but it is just silly to have this thing about it, to pretend that there's some sort of like binary opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, everybody just go out and die for the economy. Well, that doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
You know, the economy actually will not thrive if you have a non-trivial percentage of the population dying or being, you know, gasping for breath in hospitals. And even one thing people don't talk about is a lot of people who survive this after being intubated and being on ventilators, they will not go back to being just normal. A lot of people will have permanent health damage, permanent lung capacity damage. So just it's so obscene at so many different levels. And you do wonder about, you know, what are some of these people thinking? Because quite a few people who are making this argument are actually not young,
mm-hmm,
right?
Totally. I mean, Dan Patrick, the guy who, you know, really kind of poured fuel on the fire, is a 69-year-old man. You know, he's clearly in the higher risk category.
Yeah, and a lot, you just see how... you see how people build a discourse, a dialogue,
mm-hmm,
that is just separated from any real thing. I'm not seeing these people actually like, okay, yeah, I'm going to go work as an orderly in an ER without any of my, because I'm sure they need help. You know, if you really feel that way, you can, you know, you don't need Trump's permission to jump into the fray. It's just an example of how people's ideology can really get them to say not just dangerous things, but just crazy things.
Crazy.
And things that I have no doubt they have no intention of putting into effect right. for themselves.
Right.
Yeah, totally. I mean, something that's maybe I'm curious to get your take on this, Josh. Obviously, Trump can't just tell Andrew Cuomo or Jay Inslee or any governor in the country to basically reopen for business. It's not his decision. Obviously, he can have guidelines and rules that he's recommending and the White House sends out. But these decisions have been made on the state and city level. You know, Andrew Cuomo has a program called PAWS. That's essentially a shelter in place order for the state in all but name. You know, other places are doing the same. What if Trump really does say on Easter Sunday, which I guess is what, in like 9 or 10 days, everyone's back to normal? I mean, he can't actually really do much of anything in that sense, right? I mean, what can he actually do on Easter Sunday other than just kind of send out a tweet or go on Fox News or whatever?
Well, that's the short answer is nothing. You know, the president, you know, here, this is where you get into a lot of territory that has not been, you know, a lot of powers that have not been put to use. But I think the president would have fairly, in an emergency, which obviously we're in, the president would have fairly broad powers to shut things down. He has virtually no powers to stand things up, right? He can, again, I don't know exactly which authority it would be under, but again, the president has some pretty scary powers in a national emergency. He could shut things down. He could unshut whatever he's shut by some sort of federal decree. But everything that's shut down now is shut by governors, so he can't do anything about that. It's a sort of a funny quirk of how our system works. Having said that, though, he could, you know, as we're seeing with the ventilators, he has a lot of powers of persuasion. But my biggest sense from yesterday was this is some sort of alternative dialogue. Like, it's pretty clear from the sort of the totality of what we heard yesterday from the federal government that they're not opening anything up on Easter. That's not happening. But that doesn't mean it doesn't matter that he's saying it, because clearly he's sending a message to lots of people that we've got this pretty much handled, and it's, you know, we're almost lights at the end of the tunnel. But it's just one of the persistent realities of the Trump presidency that you have kind of what's really happening, and then these sort of alternative dialogues that are coming from him, and you watch as everyone around him sort of massages things to kind of do something different than what he is saying. You know, in a sense, we saw that with we have seen this, you know, seems like a different world. But we saw this with the U.S. policy towards Russia and Ukraine, where on the one hand, he's clearly in the pocket, for whatever reason, of Vladimir Putin, and he's always saying how great Putin is, he hates Ukraine, and yet the government apparatus is doing something different. And one of the things we saw with what got him impeached is where he kind of started getting in and you know, crossing those wires. And here we just have the same thing, but at a wildly more consequential level. So I don't even think he's going to try. Again, it's this alternative reality that he pushes. And then it's down to the people who in his government who suck themselves, right? It's not like they're great. They're just not as horrible as he is, right? And so they are, on the one hand, they are both managing the crisis response, and they're also managing his nonsense. And they kind of need to manage both.
Right.
And that's just something persistent in this administration, just is a lot more horrific when you're in the middle of a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about, Josh, I think has become clear during these daily White House task force briefings where Trump, Vice President Pence get up in front of the microphones and cameras in the briefing room, and Trump does a kind of a victory dance. And then you see Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, two kind of infectious disease and medical professionals who are on the task force tried to temper expectations and sort of say, yeah, Easter, okay, we're going to have to be very flexible about that date. And basically in real time kind of tried to clean up what Trump is saying. I mean, one thing that kind of worries me and, you know, that I've been thinking about is that, like you say, Josh, we've been basically working remotely for 2 weeks here at TPM. It's really only been about a week that these kind of more extreme measures have been in place. And obviously it's been frustrating and difficult to some extent just to be cooped up in small apartments and all that. But really, we are in the early days of this situation. It's going to get a lot harder just personally. It's going to get harder economically. And we're already talking about, let's open things back up. Let's get back to work. And it's been like not even 2 weeks, really. I don't know. It just concerns me that we're already at this point. And, you know, the hard part hasn't even really come. Andrew Cuomo was talking about the apex in New York being like 21 days away, a couple weeks to 3 weeks when, you know, shit could get really real in the New York area. And so just what is the messaging going to be like when that happens? You know, I mean, Trump talking about Easter, that's about when we're talking about the peak in New York. So,
well, I also think what you're saying, DT, is also part of what Trump can control. That's the scariest to me, is because him setting the tenor that this is not a big deal, that it will be over in a week or two. Like, I almost understand where this impulse is coming from, because it's really hard to tell people you need to shut down your life for the foreseeable future. There's no hard end date. You can't go outside. If you do, it's going to get worse. I mean, that's hard to tell people. But, you know, Trump just making it out. I mean, the narrative coming from him for a lot of this was, it's going to be gone any day. Don't have to worry about it if you're young. This is just going to be a problem for old people. You know, and like that has changed kind of in recent days. And now he's clinging more to like, oh, yeah, this miracle drug will probably work, even as Fauci just, you know, stepped back from the podium and was like, there is no miracle drug kind of thing. But, you know, to some degree, that does trickle down. Like the attitude and the concern you sense from your leaders bleeds into how seriously people take it. And as of now, when there are hardly any tests, most of us don't know anyone who has it. Most of us only know NBA players or like Tom Hanks, you know, because right now you have to be rich and famous to be tested, essentially. And so I think it can be also hard to live under such draconian limitations when it hasn't really touched most of our lives yet, which is kind of, I think, what you're saying, DT, which is why it can be like, Trump's idea, now we can open by Easter. Maybe people are like, well, yeah, I mean, none of my friends or family have it. Can't be that widespread. When really, like, the serious people in authority are saying, kind of what we're doing right now is what we need to do for this not to become even more cataclysmic, you know? It's not like we're doing this now so everything will be fine. It's the difference between something we are able to ride out and something, or some, you know, follow Italy's model and have it just be devastating.
Right. It's like worst case scenario or slightly less worse case scenario.
Yeah. I mean, it's in New York, we already are in an Italy type situation. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, that is clear. We're still kind of at the front end of it, but I think that is, unfortunately, sort of baked in.
How many cases in New York at this point?
In New York City?
Yeah.
In the state, it's over 25,000 in the state.
I believe it's 14,000. Hold on, let me actually bring it up and see if they've updated. No, they haven't.
And a lot of those cases, at least in the city, like half the cases are people who are between like the ages of 20 and 40. And I mean, this idea that it only affects old people or there's no risk if you're young, I mean, it's totally a misnomer and pretty, I don't know, sobering to see.
Right. Well, I think that's the issue of like, you probably won't die from it has morphed into, you'll be fine. You know, like no one ever said that. Even if you're young and have no underlying health conditions, like, yeah, coronavirus probably won't kill you. That doesn't mean it won't hospitalize you or make you seriously sick.
Yeah, the only people who seem to have it does seem true that people under 20 really rarely get seriously sick. And when I say seriously sick, I don't just mean like on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. I mean even needing to be hospitalized.
Right, right.
But that's people under 20, kids, and even 20 is sort of gets a little, you know, ballpark. For those of us who have children, it's some limited saving grace that, you know, your tweens, you can be pretty confident they will not, you know, be endangered themselves. But it has been 100% clear from the very beginning that lots of people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, they get this. They absolutely get this. When you're lucky, it's just like, you know, kind of like a bad flu, and it sucks, but you're not in great danger. You're not gasping for air. But it's absolutely true that young people get this, and a certain percentage of them get very critically ill. And some of those people are people who are the picture of health, and they are, you know, they're in their 30s or certainly in their 40s. It was really weird. Like, we were kind of having this weird, people were pushing this weird sort of debate like a week ago. Well, are millennials, you know, millennials have already gotten the short end of the stick. Are they really going to kind of like, you know, is it fair to ask them to not go to work for a while just to save these older people? And like, dude, like, A, that is a pretty morally questionable conversation to be having to start with. Yeah. But it's also factually questionable.
Yeah, there was
absolutely get sick.
I saw an article circulating the other day that was like, millennials, if you can't stay home for old people, stay home for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, there is, I'm not going to mention the person's name, but there is one person, I mean, it's been public, it's out on Twitter. This person was even tweeting about it. So it's not like this is private information, but I don't, you know, you leave it to the person to decide what level of publicity. But there's one person in the New York journalism sort of world who is, I think, in his mid-40s. He was tweeting about having it. And then 3 or 4 days ago, it came out. Now he's on a ventilator in a hospital in New York City, right? And hope for the best, you know, pray for him. And I think statistically, it seems like he will probably be okay. I know nothing about what the situation is right now for that person, but this is someone in their 40s, right? Got it. Now they're on a ventilator.
I mean, and,
you know?
It's,
and that's,
it sounds gruesome too. Like, I was on a press call about mail-in voting procedures, and Amy Klobuchar was on it, and her husband was hospitalized this week, and she was, I think, for the greater awareness, kind of running everyone through what his symptoms were. And it wasn't just
like coughing up blood.
Coughing up blood, yeah. Like, it's very dire things.
And I think he is, my understanding is that his current situation, he's in the hospital on oxygen, which is not the same as being on a ventilator. Right. That just means they're giving you a higher percentage of oxygen. You know, you kind of see, we've all seen someone's in the hospital and they've got that thing kind of
the
in their nostrils.
Where
they're, yeah, where they're, so giving, you know, a higher percentage of oxygen just to take, you know, take some of the burden off your breathing. And so he doesn't seem like he's, you know, so far not in an acute situation. But those, I mean, one of the scary things about this illness is that people can be for a while in the, oh, just kind of a bad, you know, bad flu, it sucks, but I'm, you know, at home watching TV kind of thing. And then suddenly they're in an emergency room and lucky if they get a ventilator. So it's scary.
Well, and that's, I think the thing too is like, part of you doesn't want to cling to these individual cases because who knows what people have got going on. But on the other hand, it's just there are so many unknowns in this situation, which makes it so scary that every time, at least for me, you know, I hear an anecdotal story about a young, healthy person who's doing desperately poorly, you know, it makes you feel like this disease is like an avenging angel, you know, everyone it touches, it's going to fell. And, you know, that's not the truth, but it's hard to know exactly how bad it is. And again, we still have a shortage of tests. There's still, you know, and medical professionals, of course, are like scrambling to understand it. And it's a virus, so it can change and everything else. But I just think it's hard to fully get a grasp on what exactly we're staring down right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been taking my temperature basically every day.
You know, and you also learned that your temperature varies,
totally,
even when you're fine, right? You know,
that's right. It crept up to like 99.1 a couple days ago, and I was like, oh, here we go. And then, yeah, the next day it was 98.6, and I've been fine since. But yeah, you become very aware of all of your symptoms and all of the sensations in your body, kind of just because anything out of normal. Does feel like potentially symptomatic. And I don't know, it's also allergy season, so there's coughs and sneezes and all that stuff.
Not a great time for the hypochondriatic happening among us, certainly.
Yeah, so, well, yeah, you're right. You just don't know.
I think we should just leave people with, or not leave, at least on this topic, that it remains true that for people who are under 65, especially under 60, the percentage of people who get ill enough to need to be hospitalized at all is relatively low, 10%, 15%, something like that. Probably lower as you get down the age, you know, spectrum. And the number of people who die is still quite low in statistical terms, but kind of like most of us weren't figuring there was any chance we were going to die in the next few months, right? Mm-hmm. So everything is relative. So I think it is important for people to know that young people, defined here as, again, under 65, under 60, no underlying conditions, the overwhelming percentage of those people are not going to have bad, bad outcomes. Overwhelming percentage. You know, you're talking about a few percentage points, people who, God forbid, will die or end up in a bad situation in the hospital. But to Kate's point, it is true that you don't always know that you might have some underlying vulnerability that didn't really matter until now. And there is just random chance. Some young, healthy people, for reasons we don't totally understand, it goes very badly for, and that's scary for all of us. And, you know, my only point is, I think it's important for everybody to maintain some balance, that the horror stories really get your attention. I mean, I'm 51, I'm older than you guys, believe me, they get my attention. But it is important to both see those horror stories, but also think about the broader, you know, the broader realities, but it's not a normal situation where we can say like, oh, you know, the way you talk to people who are hypochondriacal, oh, you know, kind of relax, you know,
right,
everything will be fine. Not everything will be fine. For some people, it won't be fine at all, and that's scary.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have just a couple minutes left. I'm curious, I mean, how are you both handling the social distancing? Are you able to get out for walks or runs or anything like that? Are you holed up indoors 24/7? How's it been going?
Yeah, I would say one silver lining is like I've been on my running game, because it's like such more of a treat to be outside right now that it's like, mm-hmm. even though I honestly don't like running at all, it's been made it like quite a good experience.
It's kind of all you can do right now, unless you're.
But on Monday, my boyfriend and I watched a live, like a from home remote show that our favorite comedy club in New York put on Monday's cool. night. So they did it like remotely. You could buy, you know, like a $5 ticket and they would give you the link to the live stream kind of thing. And that was definitely the most, you know, the funniest kind of like quarantine activity we did yet. We set up like a Zoom call with a bunch of friends and just had beers and watched our comedians all like doing their stand up from their home. So yeah, cool. That was fun. Yeah.
It is cool to see people get creative about it. Not only restaurants and small businesses, but performers and artists and musicians and all that, kind of doing Instagram lives and streaming
club quarantine or whatever that thing is. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. For the last, I have gotten very into very regular going to the gym. So the gym was my thing, kind of had become a key part of my day. Mm-hmm. And part of that is that to do aerobic exercise, I kind of need to be watching something, mm-hmm. right? I need to like be watching a show or something like that. And as things got tighter and it seemed less wise to go to the gym, I started basically running in place at home. That was my thing. And then for the last week or so, so much stuff was going on, I didn't even have time to do that. And I actually went for a run yesterday. So that was like my first exercise in like a week. But again, I need like TV. I can't even like listening to a podcast. It's not,
I hear you. I'm trying to get outside a bit too. And we have a small, nothing fancy roof deck kind of thing in our apartment building. So it's at least we can get up there for some fresh air too. So
that's nice.
Is there few enough people that that's manageable?
Yeah, I actually basically never see anyone else up there. So it's kind of a good situation, so far. So, anyways,
it's a good roof.
Yeah. Kate's been up there.
Yep.
Anyways, good to see you guys. And hope everyone hangs in there, all of our readers and listeners, and please make sure to write into us and kind of let us know how things are going in your neck of the woods. As always, talk at Talking Points Memo is the best place to reach us. Josh has been posting a ton of really interesting and insightful messages from readers. It's almost like I've never quite seen our audience so engaged on a topic as now, and that's really why we do it. So that's great to see.
Yeah, no, I want to chime in and say absolutely. I mean, it's your emails have been, it is great to simply hear from you, as it always is. Your emails are providing really sort of the backbone of our editorial process right now, because they are giving us insights into what's happening around the country. In a lot of cases, they're giving leads that we then that are helping us report out parts of the story. We're sharing that with the larger TPM community. So I thank you so much for that. It is really helping us. It is helping us provide what I think is an important service to our larger TPM community, and for people outside of that community who are only, occasional visitors to the site. And it is important for us, for everybody, to remain in touch with their larger communities and experience that reality that we are all going through this together. We are all experiencing very similar dangers, similar fears, fears that most of us, I think, have never experienced in quite the same way. We may have been experienced great danger or fear individually. Maybe you've had a health crisis. Maybe you've been involved, been involved in a natural disaster or something like that. So probably all of us at some level have experienced aspects of this, but it's different to experience it and everybody's experiencing it. It's not like you can go somewhere else and not experience it. It's not like you can talk to other people who are not experiencing it and lean on them, because everybody's having to lean on each other. And it is really it's a time when we all have to accept and not run away from our fears and our sadness, but also, one of the things that is really core to life at all times, just more visible and more palpable now, and that is how do we be brave and live in a dignified way even in times of great fear and danger, and even times when we might feel hopeless. And that's always something that's always central to life. It just gets, often it's not something we have to think about quite as much, but we are all in this together as a country and as a world, but we all have our own smaller communities that we experience this through. And certainly for me, the TPM community has been really critical for how I've experienced this and how I've had a sense that other people are there experiencing similar things, or there for me, I'm there for them. So keep the emails coming. We are going to do everything we can to provide the service that we always do to you, trying to keep you informed. But again, there's a communal aspect of this that is even more palpable and important than maybe it normally is, or maybe is visible. So I just thank you for keeping in touch, sending your emails, being there for us, and we will do our best to be there for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And order some Grady's cold brew on that note.
Yes. Yes. And also Grady's, remember, Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is a sponsor of the Josh Marshall podcast. They are still delivering around the country. Their operation in the Bronx is continuing because they are defined as a critical service since they produce food and beverages. So Grady's Cold Brew, again, I'm spacing. Grady'sColdBrew.com. Right, with the promo code TPM. You can get a discount with the promo code TPM. But remember, more broadly, if you can, if you're someone who you know, find ways to support small businesses. Kind of a funny phrase. Like often it's used to talk about businesses that are quite vast.
Right.
But we all have businesses that are part of our life that we buy things from. So think about the ones that it is important to you are still gonna, that they still be around when this is all over, and find ways to support them if you can.
Absolutely. All right, Josh and Kate, talk to you soon.
Nice to see you guys.
All right, later.
Bye,
guys.
Bye.
Bye.